ebony. I have rosewood. This neck is mahogany, I think. Come to think of it, I had forgotten what the neck was, but the sides and back of my guitar are actually Indian rosewood. You know, East Indian rosewood. See that? It's actually extremely beautiful wood, and Brazilian rosewood has been banned since about the 70s, I think, as far as shipping off new wood. So they're, I mean, cutting down trees. So they're actually only cutting up the stumps now of the old trees they cut down, and they're getting all this peculiar-looking, unreliable quality wood because it's cut from the stumps, where all the twists and turns in the roots of the tree and everything come into it, and they make the wood impossible to deal with. It doesn't want to hold its proper straightness when it dries up and so on. So it's very difficult. At least that's what this one-hour presentation told me, once again, something about that. So I thought that was... The man had cut some pieces of wood, Brazilian rosewood, and it used to be straight, and now it was, like, twisted in all kinds of wonderful ways. So he thought it was unusable for any guitar construction whatsoever. So that's a caution against Brazilian rosewood coming out of Brazil in these days. But this is East Indian. And the only thing you can't see here, I don't really want you to see it anyway, is that it's had a complete... It looks like someone put it too close to a radiator or something and totally ruined the smoothness of the finish. It's been sort of melted, and you don't really want to see it, I don't think. But it doesn't look bad if you don't know about that. But it needs to be refinished, obviously. But you don't really want to refinish the top because it has this beautiful crazed finish, or this crack, there are micro cracks all over it from the age of it. I don't know that it's desirable to refinish, but at some point, maybe to protect the wood, it might be desirable, but not from the point of view of appearance, because this has the look of extreme age and vintage, which is highly desirable, and it gives the guitar a great deal of its value on the market, I think, too. So I don't really want to do anything. And doing this fret dressing, wow, I got right into it. I was so, up on it. By the time I started doing it, I knew more than anybody really about how to do it, exactly what I wanted to do, because I measured each fret individually. I wrote them in the table. You saw that. And I measured them again at the end. That's a tremendous amount of measurement. And why did I do that? Because then I know. You know, and nobody does that. Nobody measures every fret. I wanted to know first of all, how much was there? That's my watch hitting my guitar. I don't really want that. I wanted to know how much adjustment did I have in my frets before I have to do a refret job. And somebody said, well, you know, you've got 35 one-thousandths, maybe, and you have to refret it, or... 50 one-thousandths, between 35 and 50 might be the height of a fret, and that might be a standard height, I don't know. So 35 might be a standard height, it might not be a refret time. It might not be needed to be refretted if you got 35 thousandths. I don't know what they were saying exactly, but it was a very good website, I thought. But it was telling me 35 to 50 thousandths of an inch is a normal height for a fret. Some guitars have lower frets than others, so... Relative to the fretboard, the wood that is, the fretboard is the wood and the fret is the metal. It sits in the fretboard. It's in a groove in the fretboard, and it's never designed to come out except when you're replacing it. And it's basically hammered in there, glued in there, and hammered in there. And it's just at a certain height, and you file it down like with a long flat file or with a straight piece of wood covered with sandpaper. Without the strings on it, obviously, and with the neck set with the truss rod to make it straight before you start, like we've been talking about. And then when you sand it, you know, you end up with all these frets that are flat, and that's what I had. So I was talking about the wood of the guitar and so on, and that was... That was interesting because it's, you know, it's worth talking about, because this is a guitar that is an excellent example of a Gibson vintage guitar from the 60s, or even earlier, perhaps, but whenever, it probably is improbable. I don't know. We can't probe it if we can't find out what it is. It might be pre-war even. Who knows? I'd like it to be pre-war maybe, but I mean, it doesn't really. I don't care. I just want to know what it is, and I don't want to assume that it's 69 vintage if it's not 69 vintage. It could be pre-war. And it really, to me, I think it would be kind of more fun if it were pre-war, certainly, if it had more vintage. If it were older, it would be more interesting because it would be unexpected because nobody thinks that these were made at that time. So that's what would be fascinating about that. But why I think that, I mean, I actually, it would be worth more, too. It would be worth tons more money if it were pre-war. I think that's the thing. But that's why I want it to be pre-war. I forgot. But anyway, the only way it's going to be pre-war is if we find out something about it that is totally unique and unheard of in anything that was made in the 60s, I mean, or, you know, something that definitely had to happen before the end of the war, or before the war itself. That's the only way it could be pre-war. But you know, I think for now, I'm more than happy for it to be a 1969, because that's a long time ago. It's a very vintage guitar. But I mean, let's not be closed-minded. I don't want to be surprised and ignorant. I don't mind being surprised, favorably surprised, to find out it's pre-war. I don't like being ignorant of that it could be pre-war, so that I look like an idiot for saying it's worth $1,500, right? Which is what I would appear to be if I didn't mention the fact that it could be earlier than that and therefore worth more money. So, and also in my mind, I might not be treating it with enough respect if I think it's only worth X amount of money and it's worth 10 times or 20 times or 50 times that, whatever it's worth. I think if it were pre-war, it might be worth, well, I guess it could be worth $100,000. I don't know. Possible, but I mean, it's not known at this point to be anything more than about 69. We just don't have the book that says, you know, that this serial number is from such and such a year, so we can't say. So getting back to it, the frets, they were flat on top, a lot of them. The ones that weren't flat, they were easier for us to work with because we didn't have to do as much work. They were already somewhat rounded, some of them anyway, but of course someone else had dressed this before, and I should mention that. That should be said in passing, that before this fret dressing that I just did, there had been a fret dressing done, I don't know when, but whoever did it just flattened the frets and they didn't do any work after that, and that's not the correct way to do it, even though it prevents some of the wear on the fret, because it distributes the string pressure over the whole width of the fret if it's flat. It prevents the wear on the fret, but it also ruins the intonation because the string is now vibrating at a point which is less determinate. It's wider. The point where it's fixed is a wide place. You don't know where it's really touching on that width. Is it really... it's supposed to be in the middle, but is it really touching in the middle, or is it on one of the edges that it's touching before it vibrates? You know... So that the length of the string determines its pitch, and the pitch is determined by that length. Therefore, the position at which it's fixed at this end is vital. It's already fixed at this end. But the fret width, if the fret is not rounded, then it's not going to be touching at a place that's exact. For example, in this case, the frets are flat, therefore it's touching across the whole width of the fret. We don't know what the true length of that string is from the point at which it's resting on the fret. The intonation is kind of at least inaccurate, but maybe it's completely shot from the standpoint of it being exact. Anyway, the other thing is that since they weren't smoothed or polished, the frets were not to try and do a move like a stretching of string, like, you know, to try to slide that string, bending the string along and sliding along the fret would be harder if the fret is not polished. So we decided that we polished, we would polish these frets. I decided, and everyone told me that everyone I saw on the internet also polishes their frets. So the problem is that you need special tools to polish frets. Apparently, they cost a lot of money. Some of them cost more than others. A diamond grit file that's designed to file frets, because it's shaped with a curve just the right round over, so that it won't dig too deep into the, it won't touch the wood, supposedly. Although here I am, I'm only 31/1000th of an inch away from the wood. Am I really going to believe that I'm not going to touch the wood? You know, but that's the reason why I taped before I did this. Now, during the fret dressing, you don't need to tape, but masking tape in between every fret, and you tear the masking tape into two little thinner strips for the frets that are closer together. But you always put the completely straight edge of masking tape against every fret. So you got two straight edges inside, in between every two frets. You've always got two straight edges. The inside rough edges are on the inside, so you've got your masking tape. And when you get up to the bigger frets, you can put two completely full-width masking tape that overlap each other, but you don't have to tear the tape. You always have a nice straight edge against every fret on both sides. So you can keep all the dirt off your fretboard when you're... And you can do that before you dress the frets if you want, but I didn't think it was necessary because I'm using a long... And many other people don't protect the frets in that case. In fact, some people don't even protect their frets when they're dressing the frets at the end. But I certainly thought it was wise, since I didn't have any tools, that I better tape the fret board, and I did tape the fret board, leaving the frets exposed in between the tape. Just perfectly exposed by the clean edge of the masking tape. So everywhere that I can see the frets, there's a clean edge of masking tape, completely untorn, right up against it. And then I thought, well, how am I going to round those frets? They're flat on top. So I tried using files, and I found...
Okay, so, yeah, that was one of those idiot machines that, or maybe people that who dial your number, but they don't speak on the other end, so they don't... They don't have anything to say, whatever, or whoever they are. And I don't mind, but it's... it is what it is, or it's pointless to me, it seems. But anyway, whoever it is obviously kind enough to call. Okay, so what I'm thinking now... is I want to describe the fret dressing, what I did. So I've got everything taped. The frets are exposed. Only the frets are exposed. Nothing else is exposed. No wood is exposed. The other thing I had to do was cut a cardboard template and have it cut to fit around the neck and cover this body. So I have a wide piece of cardboard that covers the whole body all the way down to about here. And it has a hole cut out to go around the neck, protecting all of this. So when I'm filing, sanding, whatever I'm doing down near here, I'm not going to damage this soundboard, or the finish, I should say. So you certainly don't want to damage the soundboard, but not even the finish. You don't want to damage the finish. Now, when I put the masking tape on, I don't wrap it around the neck, because I don't want... The glue on the masking tape can damage certain finish materials. So you don't want that. You don't want to... You just put the masking tape, just cut it, tear it off. I just tore mine, but you can cut it or tear it. I wouldn't bother cutting it, but, you know, it's just not, it's not that critical. And you tend to wear it out, and you have to pull it off and put more on, because you want to keep this fretboard protected where the frets are not. There's wood. You don't want to damage that. There's also some inlays here, abalone or mother of pearl or something equivalent like that. So you've got things you don't want to scratch. So... I put the tape on. I used green masking tape, but I didn't want to wrap it around. Some people say green masking tape is less sticky or something, or less harmful or to the finish, but you still don't want to wrap it around. Just leave it sitting straight, and then when you have to get a good angle, you know, a line of sight when you're measuring or doing anything, if you want to measure the frets, you have to allow for the thickness of the tape. For example, my tape was 3/1000th of an inch thick. So if I had one layer of tape underneath my measuring tool when I was measuring the height of the fret off the fretboard, I allowed for that 3/1000th of an inch of tape and added that to my measurement. But I never measured it with two layers of tape underneath, but I could have. I always just tried to tear off the extra layer and make it so I only had one layer underneath. But you have to be very careful when you're cutting with any X-Acto sharp knives or anything on your fretboard. I wouldn't do that, but I think I did it. I cut through one layer of tape knowing exactly how deep I needed to cut to tear that off, knowing there was a second layer underneath it, and I knew what I was doing, but I don't think I should have done that, really. In general, because I was in the moment and actually knew exactly how hard I needed to cut through only one layer of tape, I was able to do it. I wouldn't do that generally, and certainly not when you're tired or anything like that. Not a good idea. So anyway, I just wouldn't do it in general, but... you know, we all do these things, and sometimes we regret them, and sometimes we don't, but it's not wise. But anyway, let's come back to this just for a moment. We've got frets that are needing rounding over. So how am I going to do it? Am I going to buy expensive file that's not going to touch them because I'm protecting it with tape? Or am I going to, you know, make my own tool? I tried to make my own tool. I put two pieces of wood, clamped them together, and I drilled a hole right in between so that the drill would create two semicircular shapes in the two pieces of wood, and then I could glue sandpaper into those semicircular shapes, use that semicircular shape with the sandpaper to file my frets round. Was that a good idea? Not really. I mean, it first of all, the hole I chose was too small, because by the time you get the sandpaper in there, it's going to reduce the size of the hole substantially, because the sandpaper is about 1/10000th of an inch thick, and I even though I accounted for that, it's still... I tried to account for it, but it didn't really work. I needed the next drill size up. And by the time I had thought it over, I realized this tool, I was going to need multiple grits of sandpaper, first of all. You have to do one sanding with a certain 300 or 320 grit, I think I had. I started with 180 for the fret dressing. Then I'm going to use 320. And so I'm actually... you know, jumping up a bit, and then I want to use 600, that's all I had. I've determined before at some point, a long time ago, I bought all my sandpaper, and I decided 120 I have, but 100 I have, 180 I have, 320 and I have 600. I don't have anything between any of those, probably, but I might have 150, but I have no idea where it is. But I've got 180 and I've got 320, nothing in between. So that means 320 grit has to remove the scratches from 180 grit. And I've got 600, and which means 600 grit has to remove all the scratches from 320 grit. And how long does it take? Well, actually, it doesn't take too long, I found out. It's possible, and it doesn't take long. You can wet the sandpaper. That's another thing. And the other further thing that I did is I used polishing compound when I got to the point. But I didn't use this method of cutting a hole and then gluing sandpaper in. Forget that. All I did was, I finally realized after a night of sleep, fold the sandpaper, cut a strip of sandpaper about an inch wide and about four or five inches long, half of whatever the width of the sheet is, fold it in half and maybe in half again, whichever you like. But if you fold it in half once, I think you're going to wear out your thumb. Whereas if you fold it in half twice, you can use the stiffness of the sandpaper instead of having to use the pressure from your thumb. And you don't wear your thumb out as much on the sandpaper. But you can just go across the frets with the sandpaper on at an angle, or just basically, even if you tried to file the top of the fret, you don't want to do that. Before you start, you put, once again, I want to reiterate and emphasize, you need to put magic marker on the tops of the frets before you start this process. Then when you sand, you're going to see that the magic marker doesn't come off the top immediately, because you're rounding it over. That's what you want, so you can see if you're doing it properly. Now, the other thing, when you're sanding it, it doesn't matter if you take the magic marker off. What matters is what's underneath the magic marker. Once you've got the magic marker off, you're still going to see the top is rough because you haven't smoothed it yet. As soon as all the scratches from the prior sanding comes off the top, you're done. So you don't want to sand the top. You want to sand the fret But you want to sand the top just less than the sides so that you don't remove all the scratches from the top. So you know you're not lowering the height of the fret. But you basically just try to sand the side of the fret, and eventually you accidentally sand the top anyway. So, but you definitely don't want to sand the top. You just want to sand the sides, round it over. And basically, if you try to sand the fret from both sides, you will end up with a rounded shape. It doesn't have to be perfectly round, or it doesn't have to be, you know, completely, the flat on top doesn't have to be terribly tiny, because the more material that's there, you know, the longer it's going to take to then put a groove in that fret, and once there's a groove in your fret, you're going to have to redress the fret again. So to some degree, especially, I think, in my opinion anyway, in the middle here and up at the top of the fretboard, it's not as critical to have the frets rounded as it is down here, because here you've got look at the distance you've got here. Okay, well, maybe here you've got a long distance, right? So there's a lot less inaccuracy. I should have said it the other way, probably. The inaccuracy in length is a smaller percentage of difference here than it is here. But you play a lot more down here, too. So I think maybe it is accurate. But whatever it is, when I look at my frets now, they're round enough that the string, I can be fairly certain, is sitting on the top, because I've removed all the scratches, and I did it by attempting to round the sides first. So, and I only removed the scratch with the last sandpaper, or I removed it with the last few passes. And that might take, with 320 grit paper, it's very hard to remove 180 grit scratches from the top. Trust me, it's not easy anyway. You're not going to just do one or two passes and, oh my God, I've removed all the scratches, so that now how do I know how high my fret is? It's not going to happen. You're going to have to go over it, you know, I don't know, maybe dozens of times with 320 grit paper, probably more than dozens of times. I can't even, you know, I didn't count. I think I have a feel for it somewhat, and you just have to have a good eye. You have to be able to see it. I mean, or feel it with your hand, or some way of detecting and measuring what you're doing after, and you have to stop occasionally long enough to see what you're doing, so that you know when it becomes smooth. That's the key. As soon as that scratches from the 180 are gone, you stop, especially on the top, but everywhere. And then once all the scratches are gone from the sides and the top, and the top you do last, then you move to the next grit and you do it again. You take another piece, 4.5, 5, 6 inches long, whatever it is, and 1 inch wide. You fold it up and you put it between your thumb and forefinger, and you use it as a essentially like a file, but you're going to just put it along the side of the fret and on top, and you're going to do the top and the side like that, and you're going to do the other side. And really, because there's tape on there, you're not going to do any damage, unless the tape gets worn through, which happens, and then as soon as it wears through, you see immediately the fretboard becomes visible. And if you've got a dark fretboard like I do, it's going to show up, you know, like a sore thumb. Compared to the green tape, you're going to see it immediately, because light green tape and dark brown fretboard. So you want to use tape that's a different color, I guess, from your fretboard. That's one little snippet maybe of advice. But as soon as you wear through the tape, peel off the piece that was worn through, make sure you replace it with another piece. Start again, keep going. Don't start again, just keep going. But start again with the tape every time. Make sure you have a good, complete protective layer there for your fretboard. And that's it. I mean, once you get down to the 600 grit and you finish that, then you go to the polishing compound or whatever you want. I could have gone to a finer polishing compound if I wanted, but I didn't. I used heavy-duty polishing compound, turtle wax polishing compound. And then you just put that on a cloth to do. That's the same as sandpaper, but you're putting it on a cloth, and you keep on dabbing a little bit more. Don't put too much on, because it doesn't take much. You don't want to make a big mess. If you put too much on, just wipe some on one fret. Of course, the strings are not going to be there when you're doing it. Just wipe a little on one fret and then put some more on the next. Keep and spread it onto all the, you know, as many frets as you have to before it's all, so the cloth is not covered in the polishing compound, because you don't want to get any of it on the other parts of your guitar. You don't want to have too much sloppy excess. Then you just polish the fret you're on, and when you need to go to the next one, you know, all the polishing compound will dry up over here and you won't be able to use it till you get a little bit more wet compound and start working on it. But you've got all your tape protecting everything. You've got the only thing that's visible are the frets, and you're just polishing them up. And you keep moving, and as you start getting to them, you start to notice, as I did, that as soon as I get to them and I start polishing, I notice that the scratches from the sandpaper are still there, and I didn't remove the scratches when I was doing my sanding phase. But it's only on the top that, generally, and in some places, some of the wear from where someone was playing prior to the fret dressing are still there. Some of the fret damage is still there that I didn't remove when I was dressing the frets, but it's very minor because otherwise I would have seen it. But that has to be removed. So I either have to go, I never had to go back to 180 grit. I just went to 320 grit and kept working that one spot where there was a bit of damage on the fret. Just a bit of rough area, a bit of a groove or a bit of a slightly low area. I just had to work that area, okay, to get it smooth. As soon as that was done, then I went to the polishing compound, and anything, any scratches, anywhere else, the same thing. I just had to get those scratches out of there with the 600 grit. If it was 320 grit scratches, I just worked with the 600 grit. And if it was damage to, based on playing wear, I had to go to the 320 grit. But actually, I think I just used the 600 grit. I think. I don't think I... When I saw... No, of course I would use the... I was using the 320 grit when I first started. And then I used 600 grit. And then I went to the polishing compound. So when I went back again to fix older damage, I don't think I went back to 320 grit. I went to 600 grit. But you can go to 320 grit. You know, if your 600 grit will not do the job, if it's deep enough scratch, you just go to the 320 grit and get it out. And as long as you're not taking, like, don't try and remove material from the whole width of the fret. Do not do that. Only remove it from the area where the scratches are. If they're on the whole width, then you do the whole width. But if they're not on the whole width, just remove it from... You don't want to do any more change than you need. And as soon as the scratch is gone, always keep your eye on it. And as soon as the scratches are gone, double check. As soon as they're gone, do not continue. Just get the 600 grit and go to that, you know, or whatever the next grit is. And then work on it again until those scratches are gone. Because every grit leaves a scratch of its own. And sometimes you have to wet the sandpaper because you put more scratches on than you take off with some of the moves that you make with the sandpaper. So you don't like the way it looks after you're done. So, I mean, but the scratches you put on are, of course, probably better than what you had before, but it doesn't look very good. So you wet the sandpaper. And that'll also do another kind of... that's a way of helping lubricate the sanding, and it's another way to do it. So I just put a little saliva across the fret, and then you just continue. Keep on going, and then you go to the polishing compound again. You don't use saliva with the polishing compound because it's already wet, but you use it with the sandpaper, and then you're done when you're finished with the polishing compound, when it looks polished and smooth and shiny. Then all the frets are done, but you still then check it again with your straight edge. And you'll see that if you've done it right, and you can't do it wrong if you do it if you do it very carefully and you don't initially take the scratches off the top, you know all your frets are the right height. So your straight edge just confirms that. It confirms that all your work is correct and you've got a perfect straight line, and you can go to putting your strings on, adjusting, loosening your truss rod again, and getting the relief you need in the around the 6th fret, you know, when you're 14 and 1st frets, when you're holding those down. And then and you can use a capo at the 1st fret, so you don't need 3 hands. So it's all fairly simple stuff, but not many people really have done probably anywhere near the study that you can do nowadays on YouTube. Yeah, and I have a book, but I mean, a book would have been years ago, not long ago. That's all I would have had was a book, and it wouldn't have been good enough. But it would have been good enough to do something, but not to the level that I've achieved with what I'm very happy with what I've achieved here, even though I'm not proud of it, but because it was necessary, and because it's really by the grace of God, and pride is before a fall, as they say. So I don't think that's a good thing to be proud of, but it was. I'm satisfied with the result, with the work I did, with the feeling I get from having done the work. I know that nobody could have done it better than I did it. So I don't want to be corny, but I think I would like to thank everybody who watched. And look, I want to wish you the best, because I think you can achieve whatever you want, but you can do anything that you choose to do. It's and Tony Robbins says, I've just discovered another fantastic person that I really didn't know anything about, and he's a guitar player and a really down to earth person, and he knows a lot about what I'm talking about probably too, but he's not so much working on guitars as he is playing them. But his name is Tommy Emmanuel from Australia originally, and he does about 330 concerts per year at the time of one of the videos I was watching that was on YouTube. And he's undoubtedly one of the best, probably the best guitar player in the world, or was a few years ago. And you know, he just keeps getting better. But I mean, he's been good for a long time. Nobody seems to know about him. But I think it's because of the type of person that he is, too. That it's not the type of person like the Bible's not. It's the best-selling book of all time, but is it popular? I don't think so. You know, I mean, there's a lot of mainstream media that they don't want the Bible, you know, or anything to do with it. So I think popularity and truth are completely different things. Anyway, this man is certainly very interesting, Tommy. But I think that I started, like he said, one of his fans did to him, when a fan that had seen him many, many times. He tells a little story, a funny story, I think. There was a fan after one of his shows who came up to him and said, you know, Tony, that was one of the best shows, you know, and his name's Tommy, of course, but because it's Tommy Emmanuel, there's something about the tongue-twisting, you know, quality of the name Tommy Emmanuel that lends itself to Tony. I did the same exact thing, so I totally agree with that. But so Tommy said, I still want to call him Tony now, but Tommy said he took to actually calling himself on one occasion, you know, Tony Enamel. That's what he said his name was, because this fan, I guess, inspired that. But I mean, he's a really, really down to earth person. I mean, I think he's a great guy, but the more I hear, the more I change my opinion, and it's usually, so far it's been favorable. So he gets to be more in my estimation every time I see another thing that he's done. He's unbelievable. He learned a lot, I know, from Chet Atkins, the American guitarist, and he said he wrote a letter to Chet Atkins, and it was addressed Nashville, America, Chet Atkins, and the letter arrived. So that was when he was very young, I think, about 7 years old or something. But and he later met Chet and so on. And anyway, but he's virtually, seems to me, he's unknown. I never heard of this man, Tommy Emmanuel, the best guitarist in the world, maybe, but I mean, and yet unknown. Go figure that one. But just wanted to put that in there, because that's what I was listening to during most of this work I was doing here when I wasn't working, and when I wasn't having to hear what I was doing. I was listening to his music, and his he's a teacher. So I don't want to say the wrong thing. I mean, I could say he's brilliant, but that's like I'm trying to make him out to be not so down to earth or something. I think he's the most down to earth person. He'll answer questions from, he does workshops, and he answers any question about how to play guitar. And he's, you know, he's interested in playing guitar. He's not so much interested in questions on other aspects of anything else that I know of. But yet, you know, I think he believes in God too. He mentioned that only once in all the things I was watching, but he definitely is equally at home on that topic as he is on all the other topics. He's very down to earth. He tells a lot of, and I don't want to call them funny stories, but the only reason why they're funny is because they're so obviously honest and true, and you know, and I think he's just frank and very honest, and that's, it almost makes us smile or laugh, because it's so disarming. That's really what it is. It's very humorous in that sense. So I don't know what to say more about it. It's fantastic. I've discovered this guy in the past couple of days. And along with Emil Ernebro, who's another guitarist, and a few people whose names are just right now eluding me. But I want to discover some more undiscovered people that are the greatest in the world. I think that's a great objective for me, and that's going to be one of my objectives as I go forward here, as I go into the future here. And this guitar, I mean, I love this more now. It's just, now I've got these beautiful shiny frets. I don't know if I could be happier, I mean, with this guitar. But I mean, I would love to see the crack in this guitar fixed. I would love to see, I mean, I could do that though. I mean, it's about educating yourself. And I know there's a good luthier in my area too that I've been thinking about, presenting, but there's no way that anybody could work on my guitar better than I can do the way I want the work done on my guitar. That's just not possible, and I realize that. There's some saying about if you want anything done right, you have to do it yourself. And I found out that, recently just found out, there's a whole long list of famous English sayings, and that's one of them. And I know that my parents are both from England. Both from the area, the same area, which is in Wiltshire in England. Both my parents are from that same area. They didn't know that. They didn't know it, but I found out by family research. And we're from, we're from a lot of different places. But as far as my some of my family, let's say, we have commonality definitely in that area, in Wiltshire. We have people from, I think there's from the south of other places in England. We know there's Somerset, of course. That's another, Wiltshire is one of the counties of England. In Australia, they have states. In Canada, they have provinces. In England, they have counties. And in the United States, they have states, like in Australia. So you've got areas called, in Canada, provinces, we call them. I'm in Ontario, the province of Ontario in Canada. And my parents come from places like Somerset, Yeovil, Somerset, the Rowe family, for example, and Wellow, Somerset. Swansborough family, for example. Now, these are not my parents. The Rose are ancestors of my father, though, and like through my grandmother, my father's mother, and the Swanboroughs are ancestors of my mother through my mother's mother. So, I know a lot more about my family than that, and I was very blessed that the internet came along at the time that it did, and I thank and praise God, Jehovah, for all of that, and I do it in Jesus' name. Thank you very much for everything to both of them, and also thanks to my listeners too, and my audience, my watchers, whoever you may be. And now's a good time, I think, to turn this off and get back to whatever it is I'm going to be doing for the rest of the day. I just think I'm going to be taking it a little bit easier. And now that I've got this work done, I'm working on a song. So that's right. I want to leave you with a thought that I'm going to hopefully be recording a song and with this guitar very shortly. And that's why I set the camera up. So that's a good way to end it, I think, is to as a lead into the song. So I don't want to give too much away. Let's call it quits there. Okay. Bye for now.
Searching for the answers anymore. Way too many people rolling out the door. The world could use more people who stand up and fight. Say, make me a star tonight. Make me a star. Make me a star tonight. I was somewhat younger, I would take a turn or two. There weren't too many dumb things tonight. If it's coming in the future, we can't stop it, that's for sure. No, we can only hope the very best things will endure. Now you can make the nations of the universe unite. Just making me a star tonight. Make me a star tonight. Make me a star tonight. Everybody's feeling alright. You can turn down the light. Make me a star tonight.
So, peanut butter. Don't worry about the peanut butter. It doesn't need refrigeration for a short period of time. We're going to Deep River today. I hope. I guess you can see me now. We're going to visit for the purpose of taking some pictures of places where we have lived and been in the past. I don't suppose that we will be. We are at right now. We're in Ottawa at 5551 Joella Crescent, and it is Thursday, August 16th, 2012, and I'm Ward Green, Rolf Ward Green, and that's Ann Rutledge, Ann Ruth Rutledge. And Ann Ruth Rutledge, and we're going to Deep River. Right now it's 7 o'clock. We're about to leave, ideally, very shortly. And it's about a 3.5 hour drive. It's from Ottawa. It's a 3.5 hour drive, but we're a little south of Ottawa. It might be 4 hours. We'll be taking Highway 17. By the Ottawa River, Deep River is—it's a beautiful place. The forecast today is for nothing but sun, and we need to get there in the morning to take pictures of the houses in which I used to live, whose front sides are likely going to be facing the morning sun. So. In fact, we're fairly certain, it's just that we don't know the exact angles, but we're going to be going, so, and we're going to be bringing batteries and cameras and maybe making a little movie. We're going to go to Pine Point, so we'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Okay, this is Pine Point, Deep River, Ontario. It's the beach, one of the beaches, the other one being Lemur Beach. This is the one that I always came too, with my family and by myself later on, or with my wife now, Anne. She's here. And this is Ralph Ward Green. And we're going to be making just a short little video of Pine Point, hopefully here. And there we are, there we are. That's the Odyssey, the car that we came here in, using Highway 17 from Ottawa to Deep River. And this is Anne here. Hello, Anne. How are you? That's good. I just want to show the view of the beach, how the pines are here. There's a very convenient overhanging branch. Gives a very nice picture of what it's like here. But we have a very natural beach, very extraordinarily natural. There's the rock that I wrote about, but that now has since been joined by another rock, a smaller rock, and several other smaller ones. And we have the Pine Point itself, pine trees on the point, but there are also pine trees, many pine trees around here in the parking lot border area. So now I think I'll walk along the beach a little. Do you want to go for a walk? Anne? You walk a little bit. Okay. Okay. Get your feet under you. It's okay. How do you normally get up? That's how you do it. There you go. Now you need help? Okay. You gonna bring your purse? First you gotta get up. It's the first step. Oh, you're in bad shape. Okay. All right. This video is only supposed to be a certain length.
Okay.
But scratch my back, would you? My shoulder. The left blade. There's a bug biting me. Right there, yeah. Get it. Lower, yeah, that's it. Okay, good. You gonna take my arm? Okay, we're gonna walk a little bit and just see. It's not gonna be that easy because I gotta walk. I gotta keep everything on the viewfinder. Yeah, it's just a beautiful place here. It's always been. It's been this way for the 50 years that I can remember, or the 55 years, if you count from when I was born, it's been this way. But I don't remember quite back that far. So, there's that rock. And Mount Martin is right over there. That's the taller of the two peaks. Anne mentioned that earlier today. Mount Martin, she was wondering if it was the taller of the two, and it is on the right.
From here, they almost look the same.
Yeah. From this angle, it might look a little bit different, eh? To see the...
Yes, a little.
The Mount Martin. Okay. And there's a rock over there, too, that's interesting. That rock, that big rock over there right behind, is a big rock. We used to climb on that rock. We should go over there. Yeah, we should go over there. I know I'm going to be bouncing the camera a little bit too much, but there it is. There we are. That rock right there. And this is... this is how I know that I can remember being quite young, is because of the difficulty of climbing up on that rock, which is only about, oh, you know, half the height of... It's not as tall as I am, anyway. Half the height of a ceiling or something like that. So it's only about 4 feet tall or something. 4.5 feet tall. And it's a big rock here at Pine Point. And you see the point itself goes out this way. So, and this is how I can remember being young, because that rock was very difficult to climb on when I was young, because it seemed very big when I was very small. So I would have to start climbing up at the low end and climb all the way up because I was so small. So that is very valuable, because it gives me a point of reference I know I can remember when I was a certain age, you know? Although the I don't, I'm, it's not terribly certain, I suppose, what age I'm talking about, but maybe I'll be able to remember that too. Maybe I'll remember that too. Something bit me. It felt like something bit me, like something stung me. It felt like I got stung in the foot. I got stung in the foot here. Come here and help me hold this. If you hold this, I can check to see what's wrong with my foot. Come on. Come and hold this. I gotta check what's wrong. Why is my foot like that? Some bee stung me or something. Felt like kind of that kind of feeling, but not likely would there be a bee underneath my foot. Now, see the sand here? Look at the sand. It's got a very black... I have no idea whether you can see that on the camera, but the sand is a very black shade in behind the light color, this sort of, or on top, I'm not sure which. There's a dark color sand right here under my foot. If I sweep it away, it becomes more uniformly dark or gray. Whereas right there, in front of my foot, it's black, sort of, darker. And then if I move my foot, it sort of makes it... there's a darker patch right there to the right of my left foot. If I move my foot, all that black moves away. It's black sand. So black sand is what we have here. Somebody left some bathing trunks here, looks like. It's not a nude beach, right? So, see the clams? Clams, that's something we used to see here quite a bit. There's people out on the water. This is the way it looks on the rocky outcroppings. at the on the point itself. You see the trees? That's a jack pine, I believe. It's a very gnarly tree, or maybe it's some other kind of a dwarf pine or something. But we have very interesting some pines, different kinds of pine trees. It looks like here. See the needles are different. Look at the detail. The needles, some are in bigger bunches on with bigger needles or different kinds of pine trees. That long branch is completely different from that tree, for example. Okay, so we have these rocks I want to show you here. We used to come out on these rocks. It was very, still is very, very awe-inspiring how the rocks are, they have quite a bit of color to them, red and gray, and they have in between the red and more red and white, there's stripes of gray. There's not a lot of white, but you see there's different colors in the rock. Pink, red, you got this big bedrock on the point itself and the sand around that. So that's what Pine Point is like. The sandy point, but also bedrock. And then you look up the beach. You can see that way. That's the beach we used to swim on most of the time. And then we have over here, there's the point itself. Right around here. And then we have that way up the river toward Lemure Beach and toward the town of Deep River. If you go up that way, toward the yacht club and so on. That's it. So, Anne found a pretty rock. So thank you for joining us. And this is Rolf Ward Green. We'll see you soon.
Make me start tonight.
Hey, I love you.